Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
What's your problem? What's your problem? You know, let's do this. If you would say that you have a problem, show of hands, how many would you say, yeah, you have a problem? Okay. How many of you would say that the person sitting next to you has a problem? How many of you would say the person sitting next to you is your problem? Don't raise your hand. Today, I want to talk to you about your problem. And I want to tell you this. In a very real sense, your life will be defined by your ultimate biggest problem. Your life is going to be defined by your ultimate biggest problem. You will devote your life to solving a problem. Now, you can choose to devote your life to the problem of how can I be rich? Or how can I be successful? Or how can I have a happy family? Or how can I find a girl to date? Or how can I be healthy? Or how can I find a guy to marry? Or how can I be secure? Or you can devote your life to a bigger and maybe more noble problem. But either way, in a very real sense, your life will be defined by the problem you embrace. In fact, I think we could say this. We could say, my problem points to my purpose. My problem points to my purpose. In fact, why don't we say that? Just to help you remember this idea, my problem points to my purpose. So on three, you're going to say, you ready? Three. My problem points to my purpose. It's true. And I wonder if you have a problem worthy of your life. Do you have a problem worthy of your best energies? See, the truth is that you are living out a story. You are writing a story with your life. You may not think of it that way, but it's true. And so, is the primary problem that you're trying to solve worthy of your life? Is it a meaningful enough story? If your life was a movie, would anyone care to watch it? What are you devoting yourself to trying to solve? People who decide at some point in their life to follow Jesus learn to ask this question: God, what problem in the world do you want to use me to try to address? They embrace problems. We're starting a new series today here on Sunday mornings, and also in our online services throughout the week. We have online services that you can watch, or you can point your friends to at vivalaverve.org, and at our Monday night service. And I apologize, I'm not with you guys on Monday night. I'm actually teaching a college course all this week, so I'm going to get to pretend to be a professor, which is hysterical. I emailed and said, what do I wear when I pretend to be a professor? They said, whatever you want. So I'm going to pretend to be a professor in sweatpants. I apologize. I'll be back next Monday night. So we're starting this new series called A Life Worth Watching. We're going to ask the question, what is it that makes a life worth watching? What is it that makes a life meaningful? What do you want to accomplish with your life? How is the world going to be different because you were a part of it? And we're going to look in this series at a guy in the Bible named Nehemiah. There's a lot that we can learn from him. God put him in the Bible, and so he wants us to know about his life, and so we should. But even more than that, I want to ask the question, why? Why did God think he was special? And what does that teach us about how we can make our lives special? So we're going to look at this book in the Bible that talks about him. The book is called Nehemiah. It's named after him. And if you have a Bible, want to turn there, we're going to start in that book. If you don't have a Bible with you, totally fine. We'll put the verses on the screen. Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, comes in the Old Testament, which is the part before Jesus came. And if you don't own a Bible, we give them out for free at the Velcro Bar. So we're going to start with chapter 1, starting in verse 1. It says, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, perhaps, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. All this is going to make sense to you in a few minutes here. So Nehemiah gets this report, and let's just check out his response right now. And I want you to notice this. I want you to notice the role of Nehemiah's broken heart in his response and in this story. Okay, verse 4, when I heard these things, Nehemiah speaking, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. I asked you, what's your problem? What problem are you trying to solve? You know, people, maybe especially Christians, often ask the question, what is God's will for my life? Yeah, I just want to know, what's God's will? What's my purpose? Very often, a sense of our calling begins when we start to pay attention to what it is that really moves our hearts. I start to know what it is that God has me here to work on when I pay attention to not just the long litany of all the problems out there in the world, but what problem in that long list is the one that genuinely moves my heart. When I get a feel for that, that leads to a sense of calling. Often when someone sees a particular problem in the world, there's something that happens inside of them. It's almost like they get angry about it. It's not just that they recognize it's a problem. They get angry and they say things like, someone should do something about that. Well, Nehemiah, at the beginning of this story, does not have much of a problem at all. He's an Israelite, a Jewish man, but he's living in a city called Susa, which was the capital of Persia. Persia at the time was like the world superpower. They just dominated the world. And Nehemiah, we're going to see, has a position in the government of considerable influence. He's visited by his brother, and he asks about his home city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is where many of the people, the Jews who at the time believed in and worshiped God, it's where they lived. And so he asks about their home city and his people, the Jews there, and he learns that the city is in ruins, that the wall that surrounds the city has fallen, the gates are burnt down, and even though Nehemiah's life is going very well, man, when he hears that, his heart is just broken. Man, notice the impact. He said, I wept for some days. I mourned. I fasted. I prayed. Now, why was the broken wall such a big deal? Well, in the ancient world, the wall was what made a city a safe place to live. They didn't have missiles. They didn't have, they had a wall. That's what they had. It kept intruders out. And so it allowed people to have safety and a good quality of life. Without a wall, you would live in fear. There would probably be violence, perhaps hunger. And in Nehemiah's view, worse yet, there would be spiritual poverty. I don't know if you noticed, but he said that the people back in Jerusalem were living in disgrace. And I think what he means is that they were in this place where they're like, it just doesn't make sense because we're God's people. We're the ones who believe in God and worship God. And look at our lives. We have no wall. We're living in danger. Why doesn't God care? Why isn't he doing something? And so there was this spiritual issue that's going on. And let me just pause here for a second and say, man, we live in a world of broken walls, right? And there are problems all around us that are hurting people's ability to live safe lives, to live good lives, to be able to connect with and know God. So where is there a broken wall that breaks your heart? What's the broken wall that breaks your heart? What's your problem? I hope today you might start to figure out what it is. For Nehemiah, it was the broken wall around the city of Jerusalem. He can't stand it. He can't stand the thought of it. And he allows the pain of that problem to sink into his bones. Now, I don't know about you, but I think for me and probably for a lot of us, the problem is that we ignore the pain. right? We just try to stay numb to the problems around us and just try. I'm trying to be happy. I know there's a lot out there that's going on that's bad, but I'm trying to be happy. But Nehemiah can't do that, and it's part of the reason he leads a life worth watching, because his concern is about more than just the quality of his life. He cares about the quality of others. And so when he hears about this wall, it leads him to pray. And it's quite a prayer. I want us to read it. And so it starts in verse 5, the next verse. We'll put it on the screen. He says, "Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this, your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man.' I was cupbearer to the king." This is quite a prayer, and I just want you to notice a few of the words that Nehemiah uses. It's important, I think. So Nehemiah is facing a huge problem, right? The wall around the city, it's like national defense kind of problem. It's not a little thing. Huge problem. But he doesn't start his prayer with how big his problem is. See, when we start with and focus on the problem, prayer can deteriorate into just worrying out loud. And I kind of think I'm praying, but really I'm just worrying out loud. Nehemiah doesn't start with how big the problem is. He starts with how big his God is. That's important. Because when you see a problem in the world, maybe something that breaks your heart, it's real easy to feel overwhelmed, right? Well, yeah, it's a problem, but what could someone like me do, right? But Nehemiah, what he does is he kind of reorients his mind to remind himself that God is bigger than the problem. And so he starts out, "Lord, you know, God of heaven, the great and awesome God." He's reminding himself and telling God just how big God is. Okay, so he begins with how big and great God is. And then he lays out this huge problem. And then he says, "Give your servant success today." Nehemiah goes from being brokenhearted to being ready to take action. There's an old saying you've probably heard that there are three kinds of people in the world. There are some people who make things happen, there are some people who watch things happen, and there are some people who wonder, what happened, right? Yeah, a million people wouldn't even ask. I've got a great life. They wouldn't even ask about what's going on in Jerusalem. A million more would ask, and then would say, oh, what a shame. What a shame about those walls. Someone should do something. But one guy cannot let it go. Mm-mm. And that guy is Nehemiah. And it is a part of what makes his life worth watching. He has to do something, and he will. He's at least going to try. But he realizes, man, this is way too big for me. And so he turns to God because he knows the truth that the only way this is going to happen is if God and I do this together. And by the way, let me say to you, that is a spiritual reality that you can and should live in. There is a God of heaven, and he wants to do things with you. There's a God of heaven who wants to do things with you. And a big part of being a Christian, what it means is discovering what are God and I going to do together. And when you start figuring that out and start acting on it, man, that's what makes your life an adventure. And that's a lot of what prayer is. Prayer, in large part, is talking to God about the things that we're doing together. together. You know, there are a lot of people who say, they'll say, I just think prayer is kind of boring. I don't know. I just think prayer is kind of boring. No, prayer is not boring. And one of the reasons it's not boring is because what I'm doing is I'm talking to God about the big things that we're doing together. But if we're not doing anything together, that's going to take away a lot of the adventure of life, and it's going to take away some of the excitement of prayer. Let's keep reading, because things are going to get really interesting. So Nehemiah, we're at chapter 2 now, starting in verse 1. In the month of Nisan, Maxima, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lives in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Let me give you some context here. So it says that Nehemiah does this in the month of Nisan. Nisan was the beginning of the year, kind of like January. It was 4 months after Kislev, which is the month that the story started in, we saw earlier. And so in other words, Nehemiah, who we're going to see over the next 2 weeks, is a very action-oriented guy, has spent 4 months waiting and praying and trying to listen for God's direction. And even after 4 months, he finally feels like he's ready to do something, but his first move is not to really do anything and not to say anything. His first move after 4 months, his strategic move, is to be sad in the king's presence. He's like, "My strategy is I'm going to be sad today." And that might sound like a very small thing, but it was actually a very big deal. Here's why. We're told that Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer. That means he was in charge of selecting and serving the royal wines to the king. He was kind of like a sommelier. But cupbearers back then were generally trusted with more than that. They were given a very high level of responsibility. In fact, one ancient Babylonian source says about another cupbearer in that era, check this out, it says, "For Ahikar had been the chief cupbearer, keeper of the signet ring, and in charge of the administration of financial accounts." So the wine guy was also the finance guy, which may be why the Babylonians are no longer running the world. Just saying. So Nehemiah was a high-ranking official, and a big part of his job was security. He was in charge of making sure the king was safe, that he wasn't poisoned. And if the king, who had all power, ever suspected that the cupbearer might be disloyal, or that his focus and allegiance wasn't entirely to the king, or that the cupbearer might be able to be bribed by one of the king's enemies, the cupbearer would be terminated. And in that day, if you got terminated, you got terminated. You really got terminated. And so in that role, if the king ever asked you how you were doing or noticed that you look sad, there was only one correct response to that question. And the response was, "It's the best day of my life, sir. Every day serving you is the best day of my life, sir. It's just a joy to get to serve you. And you know what? I just want you to know I would gladly take poison in your place, sir, any day." So for Nehemiah to deliberately display his sadness before the king, this could have been a life-threatening risk. And Nehemiah knows that, but he does it anyway. And the king notices. And the king says, "Hey, Nehemiah, like, you know, what's going on? Are you not happy in your job? Should we talk?" And when Nehemiah hears this, his response is not, "I was afraid." And not, "I was very afraid." I don't know if you notice it said, he said, "I was very much afraid." Of course he was. Of course he was. And then he describes the condition of his hometown to the king. Now, I don't know if you noticed, probably not, but he never said the word Jerusalem. He's talking about the city of Jerusalem. I don't know if you noticed. He never said Jerusalem, and there's a reason for that. The king knew that Nehemiah's hometown was Jerusalem, but Nehemiah is navigating a minefield here, and he knows that he has to step incredibly carefully with every word. See, Jerusalem was the capital of a country that Persia was running, and so if Jerusalem got rebuilt, if the wall was rebuilt, it might encourage the people to say, We did it, and this is our time. Now we can revolt against Persia, and they can't come in and fight against us because we've got a wall. We can finally become independent again. As a matter of fact, there had already been an attempt to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. This isn't the first time somebody's had the idea. And this very same king, Artaxerxes, had put a stop quickly to the people trying to rebuild the wall because he saw it as a threat. So Nehemiah is not just being sad in front of the king. Basically, what he's saying here is, listen, you made a mistake. You made a mistake when you stopped them from rebuilding the wall, and you need to reverse that decision. Cupbearers did not say things like that to kings back in that day. And that's why what's happening here is so explosive. Nehemiah is putting his life on the line because he's telling the king he made a mistake. And then I assume there was silence. I don't know for how long. And then finally, verse 4, Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 4, the king said to me, "What is it you want?" Wow. Wow. I don't know what you would do in that moment. I don't know what I would do in that moment, but we know what Nehemiah does. Here's the rest of verse 4. He says, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven." I love this. Nehemiah's first prayer, starting in chapter 1, went on for 4 months. We don't know how long this second prayer was. I'm guessing 4 seconds, right? 4 seconds. But here's the deal. I think for Nehemiah, the presence of God was so real to him. It was so great to him that I think for Nehemiah, it was like prayer was constantly going on. He always knew that God was with him, and so he always felt connected to God. He always had this undercurrent of prayer going on. And by the way, that's the way you and I were meant to live life. And that's supposed to be the fuel that we live on, that we run on. This is how we start living life with real wisdom. This is how we overcome fear and anxiety. This is how we move forward in power and with energy. It's by having that kind of connection to God. So Nehemiah, before he speaks to the king, he says, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven." Before he speaks, he prays. And I've been thinking this week as I worked on this, and how would our conversations, how would our responses to other people be different if that one phrase always came first? But what if we started living like this? So instead of yelling at my spouse, "What do you mean you didn't take out the garbage? That is just like you. You never do what you're supposed to do." It would be, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said something very different, I bet." Right, something a lot more constructive. Instead of snapping at your boss when he yells at you, and you say, "You know what, if you don't like it, you can just take this job and you can shove it up." Instead, you'd say, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven." And your response to your boss would be something very different, more constructive. Instead of getting frustrated with your kid and you just snap, "That's your problem. You're always lazy. What kind of life do you think you're going to live if you keep living this way?" You'd pause and you would, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven." And after praying, you would say something very different, more constructive. Why don't we do an experiment? Why don't we see how this works? What if this week we see how often we can do that? How often, before we speak, before we respond, we just say a quick 4-second prayer and just see how does that impact my life and my relationships. Let's try it. That's what Nehemiah does. He prays, probably 4 seconds, and then he makes the ask. Verse 5. And I answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah, still won't name it, where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it. I'm guessing there was more silence at this point, all right? Is he going to die? For real. Verse 6. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. This is crazy. This is huge. Like, if I'm Nehemiah, I'm stripping down to my underwear, doing a victory lap around the room, and running out before the king can change his mind. You know, I'm like, woohoo, running around in my undies. But that's not what he does. Why? Because Nehemiah has a problem, and his problem points to his purpose. Same as you and me, right? My problem points to my purpose. He now has something, maybe for the first time, that he cares about more than his own life. He has a bigger problem than his own happiness and his own concerns. And he and God are working on this together, right? He is praying. He's got God involved. And so that gives him incredible boldness. You're going to see. It would give you great boldness if you grabbed onto something that was bigger than yourself and partnered with God, and it would change you. And so look what Nehemiah does. Verse 7. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. When Nehemiah is asking for safe conduct, essentially saying, can I get a military escort? You know, would you kind of put the military at my disposal to make sure I get to my home city safely? It's nuts. It's nuts. But he doesn't even stop there. Look at verse 8. And he says, and may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request. So Nehemiah's like, also, can I have the royal credit card? Because I need to stop at Home Depot. There's going to be a lot of wood and stuff. And would you pay for this? Like, I don't just want time off at work. Like, I want you to pay for the entire thing. It's like, ask big or go home. And he asked big. And remember, is it because he had no fear? No, what did he say? He said, I was very much afraid, right? I was very much afraid. But he had a problem. And his problem was bigger than he was, right? He had a problem that was bigger than he was. And he had a God who was bigger than all of it. And that's why he had the courage to ask for the time off, to ask for the military guard, and to ask for the king to pay for the project. And what happens? Nehemiah says, and because I love the wording he chooses, he says, because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. I love that. He's like, the hand of the Lord reached down. It was upon me. The king had no choice but to grant my request. Hallelujah. He's like, the hand was... It's probably nothing like what he sounded like, but it makes it more dramatic to think of him talking that way, right? He's like, his hand was on me. Right? He was very much afraid, but at the same time, he didn't fear making the request. Why? Because all of this was in God's hands. And when he gets granted the request, he doesn't boast. He didn't go, man, did I do that right? No, he says, God's hand was on me. I can't boast. It was all in God's hands. For Nehemiah, it was all about God. And we are going to pick the story back up next week. And man, be here for the next 2 weeks. The story is not going to go the way you think it will. Like, it's fascinating. It's crazy what happens. Be here the next 2 weeks. But I want to return to our question. What's your problem? Because your problem points to your purpose. And so, do you have a problem bigger than yourself that you are giving your life to? What is it that breaks your heart? Can you identify it? If you can I encourage you maybe to write it down? That might sound silly. I'll give you a little insight into my life. The first thing I do every morning is I write down my problem. I write down kind of my life theme. First thing I do every morning is I write it down. If you can identify it, maybe write it down. If you can't identify it, would you start to try? You know, if you're someone who believes in God, would you start to maybe pray and ask God, what is my problem? Because I need a problem worthy of giving my life to. My life, my happiness, that is not a big enough life for me to live. I need a bigger problem worth giving my life to. It's a pattern we see in the Bible, and it's one that you should know. So there's this guy named Moses, and he can't stand it that the Israelites are living in slavery, and they're being abused in Egypt. And so God says to Moses, all right then, you go demand that Pharaoh let my people go. There's a guy named David, and David can't stand it that this bully, Goliath, is taunting God's people and making fun of God. And so God says to David, all right, you go fight him. There's a guy or a woman named Esther, and Esther can't stand the idea that God's people are going to be the victims of a genocidal Holocaust. And God says to Esther, all right, then you save them. It's a guy in the New Testament after Jesus comes, and his name is Paul, and he can't stand the idea that there's this good news to be shared about Jesus, that God loves us and came for us, and the only people who know are Jewish people. No one is out there telling the people who aren't Jewish, and God says, all right, then you go tell them. So what's breaking your heart? Do you know? When you begin to recognize it and begin to bring it to God, things will start to happen. Things will start to happen. You and God can partner up, and you can start working on solving the problem together. Almost 25 years ago now, I turned on the TV one morning, and I heard a TV preacher say something honestly ridiculous about the Bible. It was stupid, but it made me realize I don't know anything about the Bible. I didn't know anything about the Bible, and that led me to borrow one and start reading it, which led me to need to know if it was true or just a fable and a myth that people like to believe, which led me to study the evidence and discover that you can prove the events of the Bible actually happened. You can prove, like, with evidence that Jesus really was God's son. He really died on a cross. He really rose from the dead. And I kept reading the Bible, and I was thunderstruck because I learned in the Bible that God loved me and had sent Jesus for me and wanted a relationship with me and had a plan for my life, and no one had ever told me any of that. No one had mentioned it to me. And I thought, that's a problem. And I went on to realize there's lots of people who no one is sharing that with, who have no idea. And that's a problem. And I was this kid in law school, but I decided, and that's a problem I want to embrace. Like, I want to do something about this. And things started happening. And 8 years later, I started a church in Virginia Beach, Virginia. It was a church for people who don't like church. And over the years, thousands of people came to this church. And we saw like 1,000 people or so who got thunderstruck by that same idea that God was for them and loved them and could change their lives. And so they said yes to a relationship with him. And it was awesome. And I loved my life. But there was a problem. The problem was that I had grown up having my childhood wrecked by my father and his life in Las Vegas. His gambling addiction, his poor decisions. And I learned that while there are some really good churches out in the suburbs of Las Vegas, there's almost nothing going on church-wise closer to the Strip. And even with the really good churches out in the suburbs, only 5% of Las Vegas goes to church. The national average is like 17%. It means 1.8 to 1.9 million people in Las Vegas don't go to church and aren't connected to this God who is for them and loves them and came for them and could change their lives. And that is a problem. And that problem broke my heart. And so 6 years ago, my family moved here to try and partner with God in solving that problem. And that's why Verve exists. That's why you're sitting here today. That's what we're all about. It's trying to solve this problem. And there are so many people in Las Vegas who are living without the love and joy and hope that a relationship with God could bring them on a daily basis. What about you? What's breaking your heart? What's your problem? When you begin to recognize it and bring it to God and talk to Him about it, things start to happen. Things start to happen when you embrace that problem and you decide, I am going to partner with God and I am going to do something about it with Him. If you don't have a problem, you need one. You need kind of a God-sized problem so you can live a big life that is worth watching. And my problem points to my purpose. My problem points to my purpose. Now your problem may not look dramatic. You know, if you told it to someone else, it may not sound very grandiose, but still it's something that breaks your heart. And it's something that you feel like God has put on your heart. And so that's your problem. And that's something that you need to work on with Him. It may be that right now, and your problem may change throughout your life, but it may be that right now it's something very personal for you. Right now, the broken wall in your life that needs to be addressed might be your marriage, and you feel called to rebuild it, or it might be something in your kids' lives. And I think one of the things that should break your heart should have to do with your church. God tells us in the Bible that every single follower of Jesus should find something in their church that gets them passionate and that they can give some of their time and some of their life to volunteering and serving and making a difference in some way. We're doing a ministry fair. I don't know if you know us out in the lobby today. And it's a chance for you just to kind of look around and discover what ministries even exist here. What are the opportunities for me to serve? And I want to really encourage you to go out there and choose a ministry position, a volunteer position, or two to try serving in. You're not signing up for life. You're serving one time. And it's kind of a test run, a kick in the tires. And so you'll try it and go, maybe, and you can try it a little bit more. You might try it and go, nope, and we'll let you try something else until you find something that you will love so that you can be a part of making this church happen and making Las Vegas and this world a better place. See, the deal is that this problem that I have, that people in Las Vegas are living without the love and joy and hope that God could give them, that is not a problem I can solve on my own. And so I'm asking you, will you help me to solve that problem? Will you partner with me? And much more importantly, will you partner with God? And let's see if we can solve this problem together. Because it's going to take all of us. And if you're up for that, just stop by that ministry fair and ask some questions and sign up for something today. For the next couple weeks, we're going to look at Nehemiah. And for now, I'm going to ask you to do what he did. You remember, he heard the story, it broke his heart, and he prayed. He prayed. And so will you start praying about whatever it is that moves and breaks your heart? And in fact, let's start praying for that right now. Let's pray that we find our problem, because my problem points to my purpose. All right, let's pray. Now, what an honor it is that instead of just, you know, kind of solving all the world's problems on your own, which you have the power to do, that you invite us to be change agents in this world. Our church talks about being all about turning the world upside down. And you are inviting each one of us to participate with you, to partner with you in changing the world. That's crazy. That's awesome. And what I found, not just in my life, but in others, is that's when life starts to become an adventure and get exciting, when it's not just about me and my concerns and my money and my career and my family, but when I start to care about something that's bigger than me, something that is eternal even, and that's when life becomes really good. God, I pray that you would help each of us to develop a passion for something outside of ourselves, that there would be some problem in this church, some problem in this city, some problem in this world that we would just want to embrace and be a part of solving. And it may look bigger than something we could do on our own, but man, that's why it's so good that we are praying right now to such a big God who wants to partner with us and can do more than we could ever ask or even imagine. And so we ask you, God, to help us to find our place to serve out in the world and also here at Verve, and use us to make a difference so we can live lives that are truly worth watching. I pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.